Thank you, first of all. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, USENIX, for giving me the chance to be up here. Have any of you, I feel like I've done this a bazillion times, have any of you seen me talk about healthcare.gov before? Okay, a lot of you. I apologize, I will go through this first part pretty quickly then, since about a third, half of you have seen it before. I realize this isn't a great audience participation format, but we'll do the best we can. Where have you seen this? Was it here last year? Oh, wow. So there was actually so I had no idea what was going on last year because I couldn't make it out to Seattle. So I did this sitting in a little dingy conference room by myself, talking to a blank wall with exactly one person, which was Sarah, was there to make sure that I got there on time. And I had no idea how big the audience was, so I guess a good number of you saw it last year. All right. Well, I will go ahead. I am going to tell you a couple of things today. One, how I ended up at the White House, and like I said, you heard that last year, so I'll blow through it pretty quickly. I'm then going to make an argument for why your particular set of skills, which I take to be somewhere on the spectrum of systems administration, SRE, stuff like that, particularly of managers of large complex systems. I'm going to argue why that makes you unusually well suited to deal with large organizations and governmental problems. I'm going to tell you how that has been going for us. So that's a little bit of theory. Then I will tell you how that has been going for us the last year in practice in Washington, D.C. And somewhere along the way, perhaps you'll pick up some idea of whether or not public service is a good idea for you. And this is going to keep happening, isn't it? Sorry about that. Okay. That is interesting. I don't need to join Marriott Guest, and we will allow full screen. How about that? The important things about me, the only things that matter for the purposes of this talk right now, is I started out a while ago. I was a system administrator at a small liberal arts college minding my own business. Was not terribly busy in those days. Is this really going to keep happening? Well, I'm a little scared to do that because it's a Google Doc. I don't know what's going to... This is not my first rodeo, so I did save the PDF to the desktop if all else fails, but I made a couple of late-breaking changes. Anyway, so I started out working at a small liberal arts college, minding my own business. I went on from there to work at a large tech company in Silicon Valley. I blurred out the logo so you can't tell which one. I went from there through a sequence of events that I truly don't understand still, to work as a leave of absence temporarily away from large tech company to work on healthcare.gov in 2013, which was the first open enrollment season. I went back from there to large company, and I went forward from there also through a sequence of connections that I don't completely understand to work at the White House, which is what I do now. So if you remember 2013, you may remember that healthcare.gov was not going super well. It was it was filling up all of the airtime on cable news in between the time when the government shutdown ended, which was October 13th, 2010, and when the Malaysian plane went missing, which was somewhere in January. There wasn't much else going on in that period, so healthcare.gov was on TV all the time. As you can see in this screenshot, well, you can't see the person, but as you can see in a little crawl thing, CNN, MSNBC, they had set up little studios where people would theatrically try to log in and it would not work, and we would just repeat that all day long. So it was getting a lot of attention. I was one of a handful of people that was asked to go and try and help figure out what needed to be done and whether or not the site could be fixed in a short enough period of time to matter. So I got a phone call from somebody that I now know, who I didn't know then. His name is Todd Park. He was the Chief Technology Officer of the United States at the time, and a few hours later, I was on the black helicopters to Washington, D.C., where by black helicopters, I mean I had to buy my own ticket on United at the last minute on a middle seat, as is my specialty. This is the original handful of people that were the first team that showed up. I think this picture was taken if it wasn't exactly October 22nd, it was around October 22nd, 2013. That was my first day on the ground in Virginia. We did some pretty basic stuff, which has been covered before, and I've even told you that story before, so like I said, I will not go into it a lot. We had all the people come to one place. This was the first of what would become three war rooms that eventually grew up to become the Operations Center, which is still how things run today. The Exchange Operations Center is in Maryland. This was one of the first changes that happened after we got there. Well, the first changes that we encouraged after we got there was that all of the various representatives of the many different companies that were involved, and there were about 55 different companies involved, and they were not when we started, in the same building. They were not talking to each other. They had no regular meetings with each other. They were not even in the same state in a lot of cases. So we had them all come to one place because with a system that's fragmented, there wasn't any, and the time scale that we were on, there wasn't any other hope of PIV communicating via tickets, email, any of that stuff. So everybody came to one place. We called it a war room. In fact, I have a patch commemorating it which says the war room on it. We installed monitoring. This is the second iteration of the war room. This was upstairs. We rented the upstairs suite. Got some TVs, installed some simple monitoring stuff. Now suddenly you could tell whether the site was actually having an outage, which prior to that we literally didn't know except by watching CNN. Fun fact, even when CNN says it is live, it is tape delayed almost all of the time, by 20, 30 minutes or so. Because we could measure the lag between when they would try to log in and it would work and when they would try to log in and it would not. So one thing I learned doing this. Once you had those pieces in place, then you could actually organize some semblance of incident response, which looked more or less like this. It is maybe not ideal that we have everybody in the whole entire room up looking at something that has just gone wrong in the last minute on a TV. But it is a lot better than what was happening before, which was zero people getting up and looking at the thing when it went wrong. So things were getting slightly better over time. This, again, is the second iteration of the war room. This is upstairs. We're still in Virginia at this point. Other weird things started to happen, and I don't usually tell this part of the story, and I'm only going to tell little pieces of it right now. But it's a little bit relevant because we went on from there, as I now know, we went on from there to become a whole unit at the White House. So how did that happen in addition to everything else that was going on? Well, part of it was, I don't know why, but the press picked up on me as if I was the like key member of the repair effort. There were actually the five or six or so that I showed you in the original picture, and the team would get bigger over time, and I'm going to show you them in a second. But probably because I worked at a big, recognizable tech company that I haven't named. I was the one that got stuff like this written about me. So how is this for commitment escalation? Like, I was just there to like try and fix some broken computers. I figured we would have a few laughs and I would go home in time for Halloween. And then the press started to write the story like this. So apparently now it's my job to make sure that the whole entire website works. Let's see where I lost my place. I am sorry, I'm going to have to look at notes now and then because this is actual new material for the most part. I know you wouldn't know it yet, those of you that were here last year. So obviously, being in way over my head and not knowing what we were doing at all, I started making stuff up. Somebody who works for me right now has told me that I have only one real skill, and that is that I can make any stupid thing sound smart when I say it in a meeting. So I'm writing that skill as far as it will go. And for example, this is a thing I made up in a meeting. Have you all seen this before? Have I done this one before? I'll talk through it really quickly. I needed some kind of device to convince a bunch of people that they actually should pay attention to things like monitoring, which were not installed yet. So we were going around having, like, here's why there wasn't a lot of traction prior to the end of October 2013. We were going around and around in circles. We'd go from cube to cube, and we would ask the engineers, developers, whoever happened to be in that particular team, we'd ask them what they were working on. And for the most part, they were working on features that were on the roadmap to be delivered like next March or May or something, because there was no concept of these things are not equally important. That wasn't an incentive that had been driven through the system very effectively. So in the middle of a meeting, when I was trying to convince a bunch of executives that they needed to spend 5 minutes thinking about monitoring whether the site was up or not, I invented this and named it the website or service, I don't know, a hierarchy of needs, which goes as following. At the very bottom, if you do not have any instrumentation, if you don't have any monitoring, you can't see what is going on in your production system, then none of the rest of this makes any difference. You're wasting your time working on anything else if you can't see what is going on. The next best thing from there, if you can see what's going on, then you can try to organize a little bit of incident response. And I showed you in those pictures a minute ago how that progression went. First, we had to have the monitoring in place. Then we could actually ring the fire alarm and have everybody get out of their seats and come look at something when something actually went wrong, of which in those days was more often than it was going right, as everybody knows. If you're doing both of those things, then you have got a shot at instituting some kind of habit of actually analyzing the causes of problems. I'm going to come back to that idea a little bit later. But if you don't have at least those two things, then you can't even do the very most basic rudimentary concept of postmortem, root cause analysis. Different parts of the industry have different words for this, but basically everybody agrees it's a good idea to try to figure out what went wrong after a big outage. Only if you were doing all of those things are you really going to make any traction with your trying to normalize your testing or your release process? Only if you're doing all of those things does what you're, I don't know if I got that sentence right. If you are doing all of those things, then maybe what your developers are actually doing, writing code, has a chance of ever mattering in real life. If you don't have all the rest of that pyramid underneath you, then I argue it doesn't really matter a lot what they are checking into revision control today. And only if you have all of that working, so if you've got all the way to the top and you haven't got the very tip of the pyramid yet, but you're almost there, if you've got all that stuff in place, then you've got an organization that can have programmers write code, can take that code, can put it onto a production system, can see whether it worked after it's on the production system, and can see whether it continues to work from day to day. If you have built all of that structure, which does not fall out of the sky for free, it turns out, then now we can have a meeting where you can talk about things like whether the product should work this way or that way. Now, we did this upside down. Which is kind of a government specialty, which is also a theme I'm going to come back to a couple times. And we were having protracted debates about how the product should work and what exactly the policy implementation details should be when we had none of the other rest of that stuff in place. So for these people to come in from the outside, and this would not have worked if there was not a certain amount of desperation, by the way, but for when we had people come in from the outside and tell them that we needed to do everything in a completely different order and our priorities were basically the exact opposite of what they needed to be, this was a weird thing. But because I drew it on a whiteboard in front of a bunch of executives and pretended like I was not making it up as I went along, it worked well enough to get the point across, and we got the monitoring installed and off we went. In keeping with the theme of making stuff up as I went along, people started to a small cottage industry appeared of the people that I was working with would make t-shirts of things that I had said on them. This was one of them. This was one of the more popular ones. I still have this t-shirt. This was another one. I was going around telling people, hopefully, what was taken as a joke and not too condescending a way, that like the things we were doing are not magic. And there are large rooms full of people, such as the one I'm standing in right now, to whom it is equally obvious that you need to install monitoring before anything else you're doing is going to matter, and so on and so forth. All these things that I had never really been forced to say out loud when I worked at big unnamed tech company, because it was just understood by everybody around you. But then you kind of, like, you know, I'll butcher the David Foster Wallace speech a little bit, where if you have been swimming through the water your whole life, you're not even aware the water is there, but then if you suddenly take it all away, you will for sure figure out pretty quick what you are missing. Or even if you don't get there real quick, you will figure out that something is missing. And that was where we started with on healthcare.gov. December 12th, 2013, I was extremely tired and threatening to go home. And there was a panic, and the way the panic was resolved was I negotiated, well, I issued an ultimatum and received the ability to hire a bunch more people because this was not a job that I could do by myself. My average hours worked during this period was 17 and a half hours per day for the 9-week period ending, because I had to bill hours at that time. I was a, this original team was hired as subcontractors to one of the contractors on the project already. There was no, we were not federal employees, there was no way to do that yet. So I had to bill hours, and the average for that 9-week period was 17 and a half hours per day. That includes weekends, everything else. I was tired, and I don't really have words to describe how tired gets in this situation. I was hallucinating, which is a thing that happens after you have missed enough sleep over a long enough period of time. Nothing super serious. It's not like the walls were bleeding blood or anything. Well, it, when that happened, it was not a hallucination. But just things like hearing your name when nobody's saying your name. Anybody? This is an audience that has been through some bad situations. So, all right, one or two people, this has happened to you. So I was not in good shape. I got the ability to hire a bunch more people. As you can see in this picture, if you notice, I'm sitting in the background at this point while some other people are sitting at the actual desk. This is the operations center. This was the third and still extant war room that we created. Things are going on. They are getting a little bit better day by day. This is the set of people. I know it is too small and you can't see them all, but this is the set of people that came to help the site when it needed it. They came, or if you prefer, they came to help the country when it needed it, or if you prefer, they came to help me when I needed it. Whichever version you choose, I will be grateful to them forever, and I'll probably put this slide up every time anybody wants to look at it, because as you saw from the press a minute ago, the attention is not distributed evenly. It is also not distributed proportionally to these people's contribution across them all. But there's a decent number. This is, I believe, a near, probably complete set of the people that helped in 2013, 2014, the first open enrollment season. Things got better a little bit at a time. I collected my favorite headlines as we went along. This one, in case you can't read in the back, says healthcare.gov is slightly less terrible today. Ads plan preview feature that occasionally works. We, some of the people in that previous slide were responsible for that plan preview feature. It's gone by many names, but we were pleased that the press noted it occasionally worked. This one says the system can be fixed. Healthcare.gov is no longer a total disaster. That was December 2nd, 2013. That story came out. And then, of course, eventually, I'm taking a little bit of chronological liberties with the story because this data didn't come out for a while. But eventually, we learned that since 2013 through 2015, that graph, which I know you can't read the axes, but trust me, there are axes there, it is saying that the rate of people without access to health insurance in the United States has come down dramatically, more than has ever been recorded since the since we installed monitoring. See previous comments, we didn't have monitoring for a while, which is approximately 2007. But about 15, 16 million people got access to health insurance, many of them for the first time as a result of the policy surviving. And the policy survived in large part because the website was managed to be patched together well enough to get through that first open enrollment season. You will never, ever hear me say that we fixed the website or that it's all better or that the problems have been solved or any of that. I know that our talking points frequently say that. I explain when anybody asks me, including at the White House, that it is really closer to we brought a bunch of really fast bailers and bailed water out of the Titanic as fast as we could, such that it made it across to New York that first time. And it was not a good idea to turn around and head back to London the next day. There was a lot of work that needed to be done before the next open enrollment season came around. So I went back home. to a tech company that I worked at in California. And I went back to what I had been doing, which is selling ads. I mean, helping other people help people to sell ads in the style in which you're all familiar with if you have systems or infrastructure type jobs. It was a lot to decompress from. I was a month or two, I was really not readjusted to normal civilian life yet, and meanwhile, things were only getting started in Washington, D.C. The lag time on the press took a while, but come March, they put us on the cover. This is a handful, mostly the same people you saw in that early slide that I showed you of the first handful of people that showed up. Some that came later, some that were more executive types, doesn't matter. But as you can see, they put us on the cover of Time magazine. An interesting thing that happens, if this ever happens to you, it has been truly amazing to me how many people in college and high school were good friends of mine at the time that I didn't know until very recently. But like reading Facebook, I was very popular back in those days after stuff like this started to happen. Just one of many odd things. I could do a whole entire talk, but I have no idea what conference would want it. I could do a whole entire talk about how media actually works, which is like everything when you look under the covers, not the way that you would expect and probably not the way that you would want. I got asked to come back in May, met the president, very exciting. That is the diplomatic reception room, also known as the mural room in the ground floor of the White House. I am wearing a suit of which much would be made later. And I went back home again. And I went back to helping people help people to sell ads so that one billionaire could make more money than another billionaire, which was how I now viewed what I was doing. There was nothing wrong with that job. I had done it for 8 years. I had a fine time learning anything anybody wanted to teach me, as the fellow says. But it was hard to feel like that was exciting again after what I had just done. So, perhaps inevitably, certainly inevitably in the eyes of people like Todd, who helped draft me to go do it, I eventually gave in and went to work for the White House because as I had been at home at this place, people that had been in the government for some time, and I don't try to tell their part of the story because they tell it better themselves, people like Haley Van Dyke, who's my deputy administrator right now, Jen Palka, who was a deputy to Todd Park as the U.S. Chief Technology Officer, and is now, well, she was before and is now the founder of Code for America, which is a nonprofit organization you may have heard of. People like them had been working for years to get attention to the state of government IT construction, which they felt was not good, and I would have to agree with that assessment. The healthcare.gov meltdown, when it happened, just brought a tremendous amount of attention that probably would not have otherwise happened, and it eventually built up enough pressure to create what we now call U.S. Digital Service. This is August 11th, or at least it is my first week. There I go. That picture was taken from the Executive Office Building, that is the portico of the West Wing, going in for some kind of meeting. This was a very, very strange week. There was a camera crew going with me everywhere I went to these highly theatrical meetings where I would meet people from the White House. They made a video about it, which came out later. This is me. I took a screenshot of my Android phone because that is me eating a corn dog at the county fair. That was my LinkedIn picture. I forgot to mention on that earlier story in the first ones in October of 2013, to the extent they had any new material, and that one guy who wrote that one story I showed you did significant original research in the form of found my old blog from 10 or 12 years ago and quoted liberally from things I had written like 10 years earlier when I was just starting to work at unnamed tech company. Another cautionary tale is all of the things that grown-ups tell you, like don't post all this crap online because somebody will like find it and put it in the newspaper someday. All of that stuff has happened. I'm still alive, so it's like not the end of the world, but it was something, all right. Here's another interesting fact. Oh, man. If I'd known you guys had thought that was that funny, I could have put 12 slides like that. because this is literally, there are a lot of weird things about the beginning of U.S. Digital Service, and one of them was I showed up August 11th, 2014. I looked up later and found out, by astonishing coincidence, August 11th is the date that Ned Stark arrived in King's Landing, according to the most obsessive, compulsive fan page that I could find that has worked this all out. I don't know how, because I don't have any references to the calendar in the books, but I'll just take their word for it, because it's convenient. And on my first day, we had a full press pool conference at noon where I was supposed to, like, we're introducing U.S. Digital Service, Mikey's gonna, whatever he's gonna do, we don't really know, but we're doing a press conference at 12. I had an audition for that press conference at 11, at which it was decided whether or not I was going to be camera ready, and perhaps in a moment of weakness they thought that I was, so they went forward with the 12 o'clock one, at which I've been a government employee for like 3 hours. I don't know which gate to go in and out through the White House complex yet. There is exactly one other employee of U.S. Digital Service on the first day whose name is Erie Meyer. She's still with us. She is one of the people who had been working prior to my arrival to make sure that this actually came off. And she, like, without her showing me like where the bathroom is, like, I don't know answers to questions like that yet. And in my first day, press pool wants to ask me a bunch of questions about like what is my appropriation strategy going to be for the fiscal year 17. So I gave a bunch of quotes that were like, I really don't have a plan for that yet. I've been here for 3 hours, and like, ask me again in a year or so. And so they didn't have any news. And this was the dead period when the president's on vacation and Congress is in recess, and they'll take anything to make news. So what they made news out of was weeks of stories like this. I'm not wearing a suit. I'm working at the White House and not wearing a suit. The sky must be falling. Now, since then to this day, here's another cautionary tale if this should ever happen to you. Since then to this day, most of how every story you read in the press gets written is somebody doesn't have enough time, is up against a deadline, and searches and finds the last stories that were written about that thing, and uses mostly that stuff over again with whatever little pieces of new information we happen to have got. And so they get remixed and remixed and remixed, like way more than you'll ever even find on like SoundCloud. So the same words come back and back and back. So to this day, I defy you to find a mention of me, certainly, and probably not U.S. Digital Service in the media that does not use one of the words disheveled, rumpled, disorderly, or slovenly. I get all of those. That is just how you start the story if you're writing about Mikey Dickerson, so be it. A couple of people made the observation to me, which was not as obvious to me as it was to them, that this is a exceedingly rare instance where so much hullabaloo has been made over a man's clothing choices in the industry. Not that unusual an experience for half the population, apparently. I promised we'd have some new things to say. New things to say start now. We now have, the logo came later, but we now have the thing that we call U.S. Digital Service. I am here. I am now senior administration official. God help us all. As a senior administration official, I am trained. This, honest to God, happened last week. Sarah is my witness. I am trained to talk for arbitrary lengths of time without saying anything. Perhaps you think I've been doing a good job so far. I'm going to try to do a less good job, by which I mean I'm going to try to say some things now, and we will see if they get me in trouble. And this is how I do most speaking appearances. So like I said, I'm going to try to show you now how did any of this make any sense, to the extent that I can make it make any sense. There must have been something that I was trained in through that path that I laid out for you a little bit, where I was a system administrator, then I ran some bigger stuff, then I ran some bigger stuff, then I went to work at a big tech company and I ran some really big stuff. I started managing some people and I started managing some more people. Somewhere along the way, there must have been something that I learned that was useful enough to me for, I mean, besides the fact that I can say stupid things and make them sound smart, which is obviously my real life talent. Other than that, there must have been something I could do that was useful enough that we made it to where we are and created the US Digital Service. And I'm going to show you, I think, what those ingredients are and how they might apply to you. I will start with one observation, which is that what we have got, the country, how many of you are US citizens? All right, nearly everybody. So the country that you and I belong to, you may have not thought about it before, is a 226-year-old open source project. If you just look at the system of laws, regulations, customs, everything as the code that runs the society, 226 years old, has 535 committers who are engaged in any number of flame wars at any given time. They have really large media outlets and the help of media training, which helps them learn how to talk arbitrarily long without saying anything, to make those flame wars really effective. There was one really memorable occasion when an actual war broke out for 5 years or so. That was bad. And what I'm saying is, not even Debian is this dysfunctional. Although with systemd, we're getting close, I think. That has been rather controversial. If you look at a large human organization, you will find that it's not that different from running a large set of complicated interacting components on a large distributed system or a website or what have you. Lesson one, neither of these systems cares about your feelings at all. Most of you probably have a computer science or engineering degree or something closely related to those fields. If so, then at some point in your past, you took your first programming class or you did it on your own, however your particular path was. And at some point, you encountered a compiler that is just not going to work if you put the semicolon in the wrong place. It does not matter what you think about that. It does not matter if you argue with it. People have very different reactions when this happens, by the way. I TA'd in college a little bit, so I saw a decent number of people have this life experience for the first time. And I can tell you at a small liberal arts college, the reaction of almost all of them is to get very emotional and explain to the person, because the computer can't hear you, explain to the professor, the TA, whoever is handy, how stupid it is and unfair that the compiler knows that you forgot a semicolon but is refusing to work anyway. And this is very frustrating. And some people then cope with that and some people don't. But as the professor or the TA, you don't have a lot of sympathy because you know that it doesn't matter. Getting mad at the compiler is exactly the same as getting mad at a lawnmower after you put your foot under it. It's just going to do what it's going to do. And by the way, if you've got the kind of error where the compiler can tell you what you did wrong, that's by far the best class of error that you're going to encounter from here on. Like, that's actually an easy one. So in exactly the same way, a sufficiently complicated system of interlocking people making decisions does not reason like a person and does not care about your feelings. I will give you a couple of real, not made up examples, things that we've gone through in the last year. We have a lot of the bureaucracy hacking, we call it various things. A lot of the stuff that we do to try to get things done is around hiring and placing people in the right jobs because those regulations are very complicated. The regulations and everything are very complicated. But that is one that we have to get done before we can get anything else done. So, for example, we needed to move somebody from one job description to another job description because the needs of the organization had changed, so on and so forth. We had the HR department that we work with basically write a job description for the job that we needed based on the day-to-day activities of the person in question, because we knew what we needed them to do is what this person was already doing. So they were happy to do that. They graded that job. They accepted applications for that job, including the application of the person that the job description was based on, and immediately ruled that person not qualified to do the job. There's nothing unusual about this. And telling the people that have led to this result that it's not fair or doesn't make sense will get you absolutely nowhere. There is only one thing to do in this situation, which is that you have to step inside the rules of the system you are looking at. Like, if you cannot see the code the way the compiler sees the code, then the things you are trying are not going to work. And if you can't see the set of forms and process and whatever that led to this nonsensical outcome, then in the way that the person who's processing that particular step of the process sees it, then you will not be able to reason your way out of that either. It is similar in that way. I made up a definition of bureaucracy, since, like I said, I make up a bunch of stuff when I don't know what I'm talking about, which is that you have yourself a real bona fide functioning bureaucracy when you have created a complicated enough set of distributed decision making that it is capable of yielding a result that no individual actually wants. And government has got that to beat the band. It is surprising how small a group of people can cause that to happen. Those of you that have had the life experience of creating your own company, where we're going to do everything right this time, and growing it from a handful of people to, estimates vary, 20, 30, 50, 100, but somewhere between 20 and 100, you will re-encounter all the things that other organizations have been doing wrong all this time. And maybe you will have better solutions to them, and good for you if you do, but you will re-encounter the same problems because people just work the same in all size groups. Lesson two, stuff that you don't use can still hurt you. You want simplicity if you're going for reliability and if you are trying to make things work in a predictable fashion. How many of you were relying on the important HTTP heartbeat feature? All right, Tom, right? One. We had a user of the HTTP heartbeat feature. I will grant that that was useful. Using the feature.
Fighting against
it. Aha. How many of you have heard of Heartbleed? Yeah. That was a feature that nobody was willing to raise their hand and say that they actually used, but it still was a massive problem for all of us. And also, by the way, I can't help but point out, what the hell, when did bugs get logos? Like, how is that a thing? I guess we have graphic artists working for us now. I guess the next time I screw up, we're going to get a logo, like Mikey's bad decision 2015. Here's the counterpoint. I know that it's too small to read, but you get the idea. It is that what I have got up there is a picture of the California Schedule 540. How many of you pay taxes in California? And I thought there might be a decent number. So if you pay taxes in California, you know that after you have had the super enjoyable experience of participating in your democracy by paying your federal taxes, you get to do it again. And California has many, many adjustments which only apply to California residents, so you have to answer a bunch of special questions about your California income, including but not limited to, I wrote down some of my favorite ones, did you receive sick pay under the Railroad Retirement Act? Did you have to pay any fines or penalties that were assessed by the professional sports league you play for? That's a real thing. Did you win the California lottery this year? I suppose it applies to somebody. Did you make any money as a reward from a crime hotline, because that gets special tax treatment? How much of your income came from recycling beverage containers? I hope you are keeping track, because you need to answer it on your tax return. And finally, one of the best known examples, how much did you receive last year in Ottoman Turkish Empire settlement payments? Now, all of those, to be clear, I am a well-trained senior administration official, so the Armenian genocide was bad. And that settlement is very important to a very small number of people, but it is on the form and it is in the critical path for processing that form for all of us. And as I know better than I ever hoped to, problems in any of those special cases I just described could be a problem that if you answer it wrong, you can absolutely end up getting triggered an audit for it, even if it's like $5 of recycled beverage container income. That will be enough to make things not match, and that will be an error that has to be reconciled somewhere down the line, or else we just have to write it off and put it under the noise floor where we don't worry about it anymore. Anyway, the complexity, as the system gets older, the impulse to add complexity is irresistible in every case I have ever considered. They get more and more crufty over time, and all of that stuff becomes something you have to work around to maintain it as you go forward. You have seen this. You know what I'm talking about. That's almost the same thing as lesson three, I suppose, which is inevitably over time, things become more and more complicated. In case you can't read the small print, this is a long ago episode of The Simpsons when The Simpsons used to be funny. I don't know if anybody is old enough to remember that. But this is one in which Homer has cheated his taxes and the government has called him in and says, "Mr. Simpson, this government computer can process over 9 tax returns per day. Did you really think you could fool it?" This is, you'd be laughing or crying a lot more if you knew how close to the truth this actually is. It amuses me anyway to think how close that is to reality. But the point I was actually going to make on this slide is, as with code, as with the set of laws and regulations and customs which determine the functioning of the bureaucracy, the older it gets, the harder it is to change. So I'll come back to that. Here's how Medicare and Medicaid works right now. Medicare and Medicaid process some hundreds of billions of dollars a year in medical claims, obviously, for the people who qualify for those programs. And the process by which the claim is determined whether or not it's eligible or not and how much we're going to pay on what schedule, all of that is done in a batch process overnight on a mainframe by around 5,500 or 6,000 independent COBOL jobs. How they communicate with each other, I don't know. One of them writes one file and another one reads it. Just the job of trying to map out which one reads which file would probably take 6 months. It has been growing organically that way for conservatively 20 years. This is so far back in the midst of history that I don't actually know the start date for this particular implementation of those programs. And this is a little bit tough because the people that can maintain that, there's only a handful of them that are still employed by the government, and they're all past retirement age. So this is a little bit of a liability for us. But I made the argument, maybe you agree with it, maybe you don't, when I was looking into the plan for how we're going to get out of that state, I don't think there is any chance of rewriting this from scratch. And I will tell you why not, which is, and we saw this healthcare.gov example, which I got in a second here. Problem is that over those 20 years, there have been patch upon patch upon patch upon patch to, first of all, the regulations that we're trying to implement here, and then also the code trying to implement the regulations. And if you had a magic wand and could take the code as it exists today, I'm sorry, the regulations as it exists today, and turn it into code with 100% perfect fidelity overnight, there would still be hundreds of differences between that new system that we just built and the one that has evolved over 20 years in parallel, which is represented in code. And a lot of those differences will be things that maybe weren't intended consequences, but we're also not going to be willing to flip the switch and turn on overnight, because some of those differences are going to be huge shifts in revenue for people. Practices are going to go out of business. They were bugs all along, but the change is going to be too disruptive. We have to go a piece at a time. And the analogy here to the larger human system of laws and regulations is obvious. Past a certain critical mass, a rewrite from scratch is not an option. A rewrite from scratch of the United States is called a revolution, and I'm told I'm not supposed to advocate such things. Anyway, it's probably not practical in any event. So, one last lesson, and I got a couple of examples, and it is the following thing. This is also maybe a controversial opinion, so just take it for what it is. It is mine, which is the concept of classical analysis, root cause analysis, postmortem, the kind of process that we mostly did when I worked at unnamed tech companies, and the way we try to fix things most of the time. It is a hell of a lot better than not having any process for finding and diagnosing errors, but you will reach the limits of how far you can go when you analyze each failure and look for what you're going to call one root cause. Past a certain level of complexity, there is not one root cause. It just doesn't work that way. At any given moment, there are dozens of things wrong in a system that has enough complexity in it. And you can't fixate on the first one that you find, or you will be there for months, and you may not ever move the needle on the actual problem. Have any of you read in any detail the story of Air France Flight 447? This is the one that just, the Airbus that just fell out of the sky. Total mystery. There was no mechanic. Well, this was obviously took years of investigation to determine these facts, but there was, in the end, no mechanical failure of any kind. There was an error, which is very hard to describe, which is that the pilot's mental model of what was going on with the airplane got detached from the reality of what was going on from the airplane, and therefore the control inputs that they made to the airplane were not appropriate for the actual physics of the situation, and they literally just flew it right into the ocean. And there is a lot of interesting parts to that story about how communication broke down amongst the crew and blah, blah, blah. I've obviously read a decent amount of detail in it, and I've also read a frightening amount of detail in nuclear accidents that have happened. And it's because a new approach that goes past root cause analysis called system safety has been developed in those disciplines and used there to decent effect for some time. The basic idea, and this is like a, you know, even the Cliff's Notes version is like a 5-day class, so I won't attempt to do more than give you like a couple ideas from it. But the idea basically is past a certain point, it isn't actually useful to look for what exact rivet failed and then make that rivet reinforce that rivet somehow when you're looking at what caused a plane to crash or exactly what pilot made what mistake at what time. You have to look at the entire class of like rivet fatigue as a class of hazards that you have to consider all at once, because there are too many rivets, you can't study each one individually. There are too many possible mistakes the pilot could make, you can't study each one individually. You have to look at the entire class of possible hazards, figure out a way to box that down by eliminating whole classes of mistakes that the pilot could make or whole classes of mechanical failure that could happen. You have to do a decent amount. It helps a lot if you have a large enough sample size to study probability of failure and stuff like that so that you can assign the right amount of attention to different things. Anyway, I am describing a mature engineering discipline all its own, which generally goes under the name system safety, and it is what got commercial aviation and the nuclear industry to the point that it is today, which is, in both cases, one of the safest of all the possible alternatives as measured by actual casualties. I mean, most people know the statistic that it is much safer per million passenger miles to be on an airplane than anything else, car, train, any other form of transportation. This is why. I went on too long again, sorry. All right. The first thing, the thing where you have a failure, you look for the cause of the failure, you patch that thing, and then you send the plane up again. That has, I don't know if it was always called this or only after the alternatives were invented, but that is called fly, fix, fly approach to problem solving. That is still where we spend most of our time fixing large computer systems. It is absolutely where we spend our time fixing large human systems. So the same kind of analysis in what goes wrong in large dysfunctional organizations, I claim, applies much the same way. The equivalent to fly, fix, fly is the belief that there must be an accountable person, and I will fire this person, and we will fire our way to fixing our problems. You know that this is what Washington, D.C. does. The VA has a lot of problems, and the secretary was replaced last summer, and it turns out that that didn't magically fix all the problems. And it turns out that there's probably no individual that we can point to that is sitting somewhere in a back room with probably a top hat and a handlebar mustache saying that my mission is to make sure that this organization doesn't work and I am succeeding in my mission. Like, there are no people like that. This would be a whole lot easier if there were, because we would just find them and get rid of them and move on with our lives. So this is, I hope I'm not repeating myself, sorry if I am, but if you find any of this intriguing at all, you should go use your favorite search engine, which I assume is Bing, and look up Nancy Levison is her name. She's a professor at MIT who teaches system safety and seems to have been the main initiator of this field of inquiry. And there are a lot of papers which you can download and read. There are also books, but there are papers you can download and read for free, which introduce a lot of the ideas. So that may be a thing that's interesting. So I don't know how convincing it was, but this is my argument, that the kinds of things that you already know and are used to can translate very easily into trying to manipulate really large, complex human systems, which is what the government is. And the technical systems are also really large and complex, but largely because they mapped the human system that built it. Which is called Conway's Law, by the way, in order to give credit to where that idea comes from. So I will end this little piece with a description which you may find applies to you. It goes as follows. When you debug a distributed system or an OS kernel, you do it Texas style. You gather some mean, stoic people, people who have seen things die, and you get some primitive tools like a compass and a rucksack and a stick that's pointed on one end, and you walk into the wilderness and you look for trouble, possibly while chewing tobacco. This is from James Mickens, who is much funnier than I am, and you are in luck because, unless the program has changed, he is speaking on Friday afternoon. His talk description was better than mine, because he is funnier than me, like I said. I am not claiming to be as funny as he is or as entertaining, but I will be able to match the part where he said he will tearfully answer depressing questions awkwardly from the audience. If we've got a few minutes left, I'll do that too in a minute. So if you feel like this description applies to you, it also applies to the people that we need to deal with government problems. Here are some of them. These are the mean, stoic people that were working for us last August. And to reinforce the part where we have primitive tools like pointy sticks and compasses, we are in a basement. We also have the first floor, but this is the basement of the headquarters of U.S. Digital Service. That basement did not have heat for a lot of last year. That was a problem because it was very cold here last year. We had space heaters whose real purpose was to keep the pipes from freezing. So they achieved that goal. It did not go below 30 degrees inside. It did go below 50 a few times. So we gathered all the space heaters and put in, kind of bunkered down in the one room upstairs where we plugged them all in. Predictably, this caused the circuits to blow. So the power went out. When the power went out, the door lock stopped working and never came back because it was an electric door lock that probably has not been rebooted since the Eisenhower administration. So last winter was rough as we were just getting off the ground. The heat works now, as far as I know, yes. And we're getting to test it right now. So the heat now is they replaced all the pipes, everything's great, but it was a hard start. Here's one way in which it was a hard start. One of the first things we had to do was go back, because every year from now on, there's going to be an open enrollment season on the healthcare exchanges, of which healthcare.gov is the biggest one. It's called the Federally Facilitated Marketplace, serves 30 states or so. And one of the first things we had to do was make sure that the second open enrollment season was not like the first one, so the least desirable sequel ever. Therefore, I named it healthcare.gov2, Electric Boogaloo. It was not news last year, and it is an unusual, but this is probably one of the few audiences that can understand that a lot of times, not news is all you're trying to accomplish. And and it can still take heroic efforts just to accomplish the not news goal. And it was still rough last year, but it was obviously a lot better than the year before, and it became not a story that occupied anything like the public consciousness that it did in the previous year. Reasonably successful open enrollment period last year. We went on from that to make some actual measurable, substantial improvements to the site, because remember I characterized the first rescue effort as bailing a lot of water out of the Titanic. We didn't fix the giant hole in the side. So after second open enrollment period wound down, we started looking at things like fixing the giant holes in the side of the boat. Here is an example of something we did over the last year that was one that we are relatively proud of. The login system, if you were really following closely the blow-by-blow of the 2013 open enrollment system, you would have seen this in the press now and then. The subsystem of healthcare.gov that did logins and identity management was itself unbelievably complicated. It took about $200 million to build, and that subcomponent was responsible for about 3/4 of the total site downtime for the period that I measured it, which was the first month or two. It was very unreliable. The total site downtime, by the way, let me say it a different way. When we first started collecting uptime statistics, because we actually installed monitoring, see previous story, the site was up 42% of the time for the first couple weeks that I kept track of. So it was not good. And the response times, when it was up, we took a very generous definition of up, by the way, in order to even reach 42%. This is just that one component. The response time on that one component was 5 to 8 seconds, was when things were up and working. And this is also the component that verifies your session cookie to make sure that you're really logged in on every single transaction with the website. So you know that it only gets slower from there if the part that verifies your session cookie is going to take 5 to 8 seconds. And it was also just the normal state was returning about 25% errors, like just didn't work sometimes for whatever reason. So you're going through a site, and remember that the way the site was originally designed, some paths through the application would take you through as many as 70 screens, 70 round trips to the website, and that's not the average, that's not the median case. Median case was probably more like 20 or 30. We also did some work to bring that number way down, which I'm not going to talk about right now. But anyway, you can obviously see how the math works out. If you have 5 to 8 second round trip, plus whatever other time might actually be involved in processing your request, which the rest of the site was not lightning fast, by the way, and a 25% chance of failing to validate the cookie, so you end up logged out again, and you got to get through 70 screens to do it, this is why people are a little frustrated with the original attempt to get things through the site. We, over the course of the next year, and when I say we, I mean other branches of that slide I put up with all the pictures of the team from the first year, they have gone in many different directions. Some of them have stayed working on healthcare.gov, reorganized as a private company-ish of their own. Some of them have stayed working on healthcare.gov, working for the contractors that were already on the project. Some of them have come to the federal government, which is my branch. So these details are not even interesting enough to be worth explaining. Just understand that I don't mean I personally did this, but we helped participate in a project that replaced that with a thing that's now called SLS, which I think we backronymed it to Scalable Login Service. It was originally simple, but it ended up not being super simple in the end, as tends to happen. That thing, we say it cost $4 million to build, and that's because we're taking a tremendously generous estimate, and also because nobody in the government can understand a number any smaller than a few million. And like literally, the way the accounting is done does not have a line item to account for this separately, so we know it is strictly less than that amount that we spent on the salaries of the handful of people that implemented the replacement here. When we cut over to it, on the day of the cutover, I was as nervous as anybody else because now this is us on the line, right? And there were four errors that day. Might have been six, but I think it was four. That's not 4%, that is four errors. And just so that you know, I'm not cheating, there were hundreds of thousands of logins at the time. It wasn't 4 out of 10 or something like that. So the failure rate is too small, really, to measure. The only times it has failed to process a request, there's been an actual, like, comprehensible reason for it. And it, because this job really isn't that hard, it responds in something like 20, 30 milliseconds, something like that. Order of magnitude improvement on any metric you want to look at. The team that did this did a really good job, and they're working right now on replacing other parts of the site, the eligibility determination engine, which does a lot of the work. That's a thing that we did over the last year. Here's a different thing that we did over the last year. Have any of you, this is probably, well, I guess I'll just ask. Have any of you noticed the college scorecard? A few. Yeah, I didn't expect a ton. You would need to have somebody applying to college or related to you applying to college that you knew about. But the idea here comes from a policy idea that the president, the administration came up with 2-3 years ago, which says that the government has some unique advantages in trying to address this question. We have the idea in our heads that we aren't doing enough to make it easy for the sets of people that would really benefit the most from the economic advantages of getting a college education to get matched to a program which is going to give them a good result. We're not talking here about, this is a criticism that I hear a lot, and I'm going to preempt it right now and say, the purpose of getting into this data isn't because we care about whether Harvard or Yale is ranked number one this year. Like, that doesn't matter. The set of people that have that kind of support system that are going to apply to Harvard or Yale, like, they're going to do it anyway. And no piece of government data that we release that says that it's not the best economic value is going to change their behavior, and that's fine. We don't care. They're going to do fine anyway, that set of people. What we're trying to get at here is a tremendous population in the United States of first generation in their family to consider going to college. They're making a very different set of trade-offs. They're deciding whether to actually do, like, and if you don't have anybody else in your family, you don't have who assumes that this is the thing to do, if you don't have a high school guidance counselor who assumes that this is the thing to do, then it looks on the face of it like a pretty crazy decision to make. I'm gonna spend, what, $100,000+ to go to school for 4 more years, and I didn't necessarily enjoy the last 4 years of school, by the way. I say this with some sympathy because I was definitely in the category of people that did not enjoy school a ton. Instead of what? Like, I could buy 2 cars for that. I could place a down payment on a house for sure. And in a lot of parts of the country, I could buy a house for that. So am I really going to do this or not? And if I'm considering that decision, there is actually a substantial difference in the quality of the programs in the big fat part of the center part of the curve of the educational institutions that we have. State schools are not all created equal, and the kinds of schools that are competitive with state schools are not all created equal. We would like it if the people who are looking for an economic benefit, earnings over the rest of their life, by going, you know, this is your best, this is still today, even though the things have changed a little bit over the last 20 years, this is still your best way to get into the middle class, and we would like it. This is an administration policy, you can agree with it or not, but we would like it if those people had better outcomes and better access to be able to do so. So that was the problem. that we were out for. We got involved early last year when there was not a lot of time left to implement the program, not early last year, early this year, March, April or so, when we were up against a deadline where we wanted to have before the start of the 2015 school year, so by August or September, this program was supposed to be available. We constructed the team, led by someone named Lisa Globder, who tells the story better than I do. These are her slides. And the technical part, well, I'll just tell a story. A lot of what we did here was the user research about what we should actually build. This was a little bit unusual case for us in that we were involved very early in the life cycle of the project, and we were very much intertwined with the process of making the policy decisions. So the policy and the product grew up hand in hand. Instead of there being a decision handed down on stone tablets from a meeting that was done, you know, 2 years ago or whatever, that was where we started. But when we got involved, it became a little bit more fluid, because we had enough credibility at that point to say things like, you know, we have gone to Anacostia High School, which is here, it's just outside DC, and talked to a bunch of high school students, and it turns out they are not searching for the things that you thought that they would search for. Therefore, we are wasting our time if we build this feature and that feature. What we should do instead is this other feature and the other feature. And we had a negotiation like that so that we could actually get a product that hopefully served the end user's needs. This picture here shows a paper mock-up that we made. This is another thing we like to say. It was like a dollar worth of material. We like to point that out because a lot of contracts for user research are going to cost more than a dollar, it turns out. The end product looks something like this. The URL, I think, is on my next slide here, two slides away. It was designed to work on phones, a really surprising, most of you must know this by now because this has become basically conventional wisdom, but a really surprising amount of the traffic on any service, and particularly the audience we're talking about here, comes from phones. So this needed to work on a phone. That's actually more important than it working on a desktop computer. Just an aside, but it was truly staggering how much of the traffic on healthcare.gov from the very beginning came from mobile devices. And especially in 2013, the site wasn't designed to work at all on a phone, so you're like doing the horizontal scrolling thing to get through every single page. And for the most part, we're not talking about like Galaxy Notes and Nexus phones that have like giant screens. We aren't talking about the premium $800 smartphones. Most of our traffic was from kind of the, you know, the Verizon free phone with maybe not the highest resolution screen. I can't imagine that they were having a very good time. But the point of the story is, as part of doing user research, we looked at where the traffic was going to come from. It turns out it's going to come from mobile. This is what the site does look like on a desktop. It just takes the same kind of stuff that would have been in a big vertical pile and uses the page, obviously, as one would reasonably do. The default statistics that are shown are stuff that we had user input to suggest that people would actually look at. It's answering questions like the average annual cost, which is a hard thing to get the answer of, because it's not the sticker price of the school. But we know it because we finance via student loans a huge amount of the college education that goes on in the country. So that is data you can get from the government, and kind of only from the government without resorting to like a survey. Graduation rate, which is also stuff that we know because we finance your student loans. And then salary for a certain number of years after attending, which is stuff that really only the government can do with any reliability. Because you all know, colleges study this, some of them. They would do it by way of a alumni survey. Alumni surveys have obvious problems and sampling bias in who responds to them and whose address hasn't changed a few years after graduation, who's still mailing in the survey. I don't probably need to go into that a ton. You can probably obviously see the methodological problems with the ways that we have studied economic outcomes of degree programs in the past. But we're the government. It turns out you have to tell us how much money you make every year forever. So we have that information. So this is a question we can answer, and that's the data that you see here. It was went live on September 12th, 2015. Had a million or so users, and this is an old number. So it was a million or so users in the first few days after the launch. That's unique users. 5 million page views. Blah blah blah. For comparison, the previous version of the College Scorecard, there was one. It got about 150,000 users in the previous calendar year, which is a number I will never forget because the president asked me in a meeting and I did not know. So I had to go look it up. And now I know that there are about 150,000 users in the College Scorecard in the previous year. And the other interesting point here, which some of you may care about, is that this was done with an open data release. There is, you can download a giant, I think it's a CSV file, whatever the format is. You can download a giant bundle of the entire data set at once if you want to. You can do whatever you want with it. If you are a person who makes data visualizations or you're in the policy space for some reason, you can use this to draw your own conclusions and publish your own ratings however you want to. Go nuts. There is an API that you can interact with if you want to build an online transactional service. And the thing that you saw here is built on that API. So all of the things I just said are very unusual in construction of government services. So I am quite pleased with how this turned out. If you see Lisa Globder, tell her she did a good job. One last thing, and I wanted to leave a little bit of time for questions, so I'm going to end up pretty quick here. This is Veterans Day. This should have been a day off for us. It is not a day off for us because we came here to talk to you. More importantly, it is a day when we are supposed to be thinking about everybody who has served in the armed forces. And there are some serious problems confronting the people who served in the armed forces. You have all been exposed to, if you don't remember exactly, the disability claims backlog. So we are producing, thanks to a bunch of policy decisions that this particular senior administration official isn't supposed to comment on, we are producing disabled veterans at a rate faster than we can process their claims or take care of them in any serious way. At one point, a year and a half ago or so, there were about 700,000 or 800,000 claims waiting to be adjudicated. In most cases, these are people with multiple disabilities. They're quite often amputees, they're quite often hearing loss, and they are almost always somewhere on the depression or post-traumatic stress syndrome disorder. Now, all of those things, particularly that last one, depression and PTSD and untreated mental health issues, have very serious consequences if we do not get to you in the treatment line in time. Veteran homelessness has been a problem, and all those other things have been a problem. So we need to do a better job inside the VA. The VA is where we have had the largest amount of resources from U.S. Digital Service dedicated over the last year. It doesn't, unfortunately, give me any real good screenshots because we are talking about mostly internal processes of how those forms are processed, adjudicated, routed from one place to another so that you get your decision, and ultimately you get seen by a doctor. This is just a really quick example. This is an older iteration of the spinal cord injury app that clinicians use to enter information about a treatment plan for somebody with a spinal cord injury. There are a handful of centers around the United States that specialize in this type of disability. This is the old thing. This is the new thing that we're working on. I know there's not a lot you can tell from the screenshots other than that we are trying to do things in a modern way so that the workforce is more productive and we have better retention among the people who process these claims because that has been an issue. It's also an issue at Social Security, which is a whole other 15-minute story I could tell you. And the goal of all this is to process those claims faster so the people who need treatment get it more quickly. Oh, sure. Thank you. That disability backlog, by the way, I should point out, is a fraction of what it used to be. It is still probably in the neighborhood of 100,000. but I don't remember exactly. It is basically on track to being eliminated. I can't take a ton of credit for that. It was mostly done by brute force and by reorganizations inside the Veterans Administration, but we did contribute where we could. All right, wrapping this up. We continue to get a surprising to me amount of media attention. They continue to put us on the covers of magazines, although this time they went with a picture of the president. I guess he's a bigger name than us still somehow. This is the Fast Company from last summer. I put it up here mostly because I wanted to point this out to you. I am quite pleased with, for the first day this came out, and I'll zoom in so you can see it. The first day this issue came out, we did manage to beat out. We are article number 1 and 2. We were ahead of article 3, which is how the most successful people poop at work. It did not stay that way for the whole week, but we were. But on the day it came out, a lot of people were interested. So great. This is something called the Web Design Standards, and I'll cover this quickly. These are a bunch of screenshots of federal websites, which I think you will probably agree we are getting significantly better at this. Now, the government has so many websites that I have no doubt you have interacted with some really crappy ones recently. But the stuff that has been going on recently, agencies are actually hiring competent designers who can make things that are visually appealing and easy to interact with. This is a bunch of collection of them that are relatively recent government websites. They are, however, not standardized. And I'm not actually a person who gets super worked up about that. I don't care a ton whether one agency's website makes the buttons green and the other one makes the buttons blue. It does, however, mean a tremendous amount of duplicated work, which ultimately you pay for. So to try to speed up the process of making visually appealing websites that you can interact with in a reasonable way, we had a project. This one was led by Molly Ruskin, who is part of the U.S. Digital Service. This is a survey of the various brand assets, I think this is called. This is not my field, so I will get the terminology not quite right, but this is a survey of how different things look across the government websites. We did a bunch of comparative work. This is this whole set of boards for user testing different combinations of typography. The standards are based on open source fonts, which are optimized for screen legibility. This was released a couple of months ago. The URL is right there, playbook.cio.gov/design-standards. Don't get me started on that. We've had a lot of debates about URLs in my year here. As usual, the press loved it. Making the US government's web design less sucky is what The Atlantic went with. The Wired was a little bit meaner. New standards could make government websites less worthless. So we don't have, you know, we have a little bit of a negative brand equity around government technology. But that means that the bar is very, very low and easy for us to clear on project after project. And I will end with a couple of questions. These are nothing but representative of the kinds of things that you might think about that you could, if you buy my argument that the kinds of skills that you have already got for interacting with large, complicated, distributed computer systems are not that different from what you need to interact with large, complicated bureaucracies, these are some things that you could apply those skills to if you so chose. Take all that systems engineering, all of that analysis framework that I talked about, and answer questions like, how do we make sure that nobody goes bankrupt anymore under student loan debt? There's not good reasons for that to happen. I talked a little bit about how there's great variation in quality of degree programs and economic returns. There are also deferred repayment programs that anybody who is actually in real danger of going bankrupt under student debt should qualify for, that should relieve that burden significantly, but they aren't used well enough. That is a problem. That is a systems and process engineering problem. How are we going to make sure that we take in as many refugees as the law allows? That is also a systems engineering and process problem that somebody could solve. This is a big one. This is not unique to government, by the way. How are we going to fix our online identity problem? How many of you have some kind of free credit monitoring, secure, whatever thing right now because of your PII being stolen from some company or another? Yeah. And I'll bet it's a lot more of you than even raised your hand. Yeah, okay. Yes, USA. And then, of course, again, if you follow the news, the situation with all of the information getting stolen from OPM last spring is not good. This is something we have to get better at. This is less of a process engineering thing, and there's some genuine technology work that needs to be done. We know like what it would look like. We know that multi-factor authentication will put a huge dent in this, an actual strong, you know, cryptography here. But we are a long way from getting that adopted on a scale that's big enough to help. So that needs attention. And what would we do to make, sorry, been talking a while. What would we do to make criminal background checks faster and more reliable than they currently are? Also, a systems engineering and process problem. This is what we look like today. This is not entirely strictly my group. These are a couple of allied groups that showed up to do one big family picture, including the group called 18F, which is based out of GSA, but that is approximately how many people we've got to work with right now, about 180, 200 or so. I'm in there somewhere. Most people, well, most of my group's in there somewhere, obviously. We continue to learn new things. We're having a good time learning whatever anybody will teach us, such as you see here. We are at the FBI Academy in Quantico. We hang out at Camp David. This is Sarah with Admiral Grace Hopper's original nanosecond. That's pretty cool, yeah. If you don't know, go and look. Admiral Hopper was a very early pioneer in the computer science. She did this largely from her job in the Navy. And you can find her on The Tonight Show. A thing that she did that she was known for was she handed out little pieces of wire about this long and told people they were nanoseconds. Everybody said, what the hell are you talking about? Well, a nanosecond was the length of time it would take. I'm not sure if it was speed of light or the electrical impulse through copper. I don't remember this part. But it was about that long. She would hand people that and tell them, you need to understand things like propagation of speed of light because it affects computation speed and a bunch of stuff. So she had these physical props. One of them and a bunch of other Grace of Admiral Hopper's stuff is in a drawer at the U.S. Naval History and Heritage Command, which is here in town. They don't have a museum for it, but they have all of the stuff, and maybe one day it will be on display where anybody can go look at it. That is us. Thank you for listening, and I have got a couple of minutes left if anybody wants to ask a couple of questions. So thank you very much, and if you would like to follow up, that is how you could do it.
Yes. So a couple of years ago, I think we heard a lot about the problem with government technology being one of perverse incentives, and namely that government technology employees were encouraged to, as junior employees, to amass degrees and certifications to whether or not they were useful because they were externally verifiable ways to increase your salary. If you're senior employees, amass as many employees as possible and spend as much money doing things as you can because that's a way to gain power. And on the contractor side, that contractors were chosen for their core competency in government IT, which was, of course, writing bids.
Correct.
For the government.
Yep.
Do you think that's a good analysis, and do you think that there's anything being done about it?
Basically, yeah. That's a whole other half-hour story, which most people who aren't already in the government game go to sleep for, so I don't tell in a venue like this. But yes, I don't know a ton about the certification thing you mentioned. I haven't come across that one much. But the other stuff you said, I certainly have seen firsthand. The incentives are completely screwed up. That is how we get to the situation where we hire the same handful of people to burn huge amounts of money in wheelbarrows time and again without anything to show for it. To the extent that we have a strategy for fixing that, for raising the water level so all of the boats will get better, I gave you a few examples of a few things that we are doing hands-on, right? And my group, even the 100-something, 200 people that you saw, That's up against an establishment which is 186,000 federal employees in the IT specialist category. And that's not even counting contractors. And literally nobody knows how many contractors there are, but probably at least 10, if not 100 times that many. So our little hardy band of mean, stoic people is, to be optimistic, 1/1,000th the size of the establishment. And so to the extent we have a strategy to affect things across the board, it is, one, do some very high visibility work, such as what I just told you about, which will set people's in the government standards to a different point from where they are right now, because we are way too willing to accept poor quality work than we should be. And then at the same time, we have to do a lot of work, which is mostly not technical, but all of your skills would be very useful to manipulate the application of the bureaucracy, which is to introduce meaningful competition into that contracting universe. I think that of the $84 billion approximately we spend a year on IT contracting, we probably always will spend something close to that. I am not claiming that we need to bring in-house the whole entire thing. That would be, even if we're doing a great job, an agency of tens of thousands of people, and I see no appetite to do that. The UK tried that, and if you are interested, go look up the Government Digital Service. They have centralized a lot more and taken a lot more in-house than we have been able to do. So I live in a world where almost all the work is still going to be done by the private sector, and what we have to do is make it so that the rewards that companies are actually rewarded for stuff that we actually want, like building working products, and that the access to that marketplace is easier so that there can be more meaningful competition than there is today.
Thanks.
Thank you for the question. We'll do this one.
You mentioned cryptography right at the end there regarding authentication.
Yeah, I'm afraid I know where this is going to go.
Well, hopefully this isn't a gotcha question, right?
All right.
I wonder what kind of voice you have internally on policy issues around, there's a lot of policy issues around cryptography, but certainly other policy issues as well. Are you sort of taken as an authority and someone who has their finger on the pulse of real technology within the White House?
Yeah. It is considered, here's my media training. It is considered poor form to talk too much about internal deliberations, so I'm going to be more vague than I would really like to be. But we have the attention and support of the most senior decision makers on big policy decisions like that. And they do invite us into the room when we're talking about something which is going to affect tech policy in the United States in general, not only when we're doing the college scorecard or something like that. And I will point out another fact, which I'm relatively happy about, which is that the administration made a public statement a month ago or so saying that this administration is not going to seek legislation that would limit the use of strong cryptography in private products. Yes.
How could the upcoming election affect your funding?
Oh man, you guys are good. How could the upcoming election affect our funding? To answer the question narrowly, as it was actually posed, the upcoming election isn't going to make any difference to our budget situation because I already have the most hostile possible situation, between Congress and the White House. It's hard to imagine how that could get worse, right? There's a tremendous Republican majority in both houses right now, and that Republican majority, I read the same news you do, so I'm not revealing any great state secrets here when I say it doesn't seem particularly inclined to cooperate with the White House on White House priorities that it would like to do. It was genuinely a big surprise to us last year in December when the previous Congress, which was split chambers, but the House was still controlled by the Republican Party, and the House has more, House drives the budget conversation for the most part. They funded us to the full request of $20 million, which really came out of left field. When I was hired, here's that commitment escalation thing again. When I took this job, I thought we were going to hire about 10 people. We had a few million dollars in something called the Information Technology and Oversight Reform Fund, and we were making a pitch to add more money to it, and I didn't really think it would succeed. But even with last year's Congress, they funded it to the full request that we asked for. Now, we made, in fine government fashion, we made a much bigger request for 2016 and 2017. We will probably not get all of it. That's true for 2016, I don't know yet. The way this works, we're under a continuing resolution right now. I'll try not to put you all to sleep, but we're under a continuing resolution right now. That will expire on December 11th, which means that by December 11th, either Congress has to have passed an actual spending bill with actual numbers in it, which tell us how much budget we have to work with next year, or it has to pass another continuing resolution kicking the can again, or there's a government shutdown. And I don't know anymore than anybody else does which one of those things is going to happen. But I am relatively confident that just bureaucracy working the way it does, the fact that we were funded last year means that we are probably going to be funded to a similar amount this year, and that will be the default outcome ever after. Now, they could take a special interest in changing that number either up or down, but odds are I'll get something similar to the $20-25 million that is what looks like is going to come out this year. So of the things I am worried about on that whole list, running out of funding has not been a problem for us yet. Another question.
Hi, Mikey. In 2009, Dan Risiker at the DOD CIO's office issued an edict about the government has to, or at least the DOD has to use open source on an equal footing with commercial software.
Yep.
And it's not a panacea, but it's definitely a quiver in your arrow to drive down costs, et cetera.
Yep.
So the problem, however, is that it's not really on an equal footing in many of the procurement processes, et cetera.
Yep.
So I'm okay. You're agreeing with me a lot.
Sorry. What was the last thing you said? Sorry.
That you're agreeing with me. But so I'm trying to get from you. So here we are in 2015. You know all this stuff. And assuming that you are a proponent of appropriate, prudent use of open source, what have you found, like being in the belly of the beast, to help get that procurement be a little more equal footing?
Were any of you at OSCon in Portland a little while ago? Probably a few of you were. I talked about that a little bit there. I actually was more free to talk about it then than I am right now because there's some policy discussion underway right now. The problems you identified, yes, I don't need to be convinced. It mostly boils down to the people who are making these decisions inside the government. There's a whole spectrum of opinions for and against open source. It's basically the same as you saw in the tech industry if you go back 20 years, which is kind of true of a lot of things in government, is like welcome to 1985 over again. I don't see entrenched, like the government doesn't have a institutional position for or against open source. I think that the neutrality guidance that you're making reference to, which yes, it's not only the DOD. There's been other memos directing the rest of the agencies to also treat it in a tech neutral fashion. That is the law of the land. However, especially a free project doesn't have lobbyists, right, and doesn't have salespeople, and doesn't charge enough money. Like literally, it is tough to get people to believe that you can replace something that we've been spending $200 million on with something that is going to cost, I don't know, $100,000. Like I can't even measure because all I'm going to do is pay one or two people to install it. Those disadvantages are real. And the best I can say on as far as can I imagine policy actions which would drive greater adoption at a faster rate? Yes, I can. And please stay tuned for future updates. I think we can do one more, so I'm sorry, but we'll do yours.
Hi, thank you. You told us a little bit, a couple of things about how the journalists don't act the way we hope or expect them to.
Yeah.
And the same was true. You weren't what they expected because of the way you dressed. So that was what they wrote about. So what do you suppose the articles about you would have looked like if you had looked the way they expected.
So the question is, what would I have rather them write about rather than me not wearing a suit for the last year?
No, what do you think they would have written about?
What?
You're a geek who wears a suit.
Yeah. Well, so I genuinely worried about that in the beginning, and I don't know whether I was worried about the right things or not, but like I thought, here I am. I am. To be clear, I'm not the first, but I am a relatively high visibility person leaving the private tech industry on the West Coast, coming into the government and the administration in a fairly high visibility place. Lots of people from unnamed tech company are watching to see how this plays out. Now, of course, with the amount of attention we've gotten, people from across the industry are watching to see how this plays out. And I was pretty sure that if there were a bunch of pictures and whatever of me going to a bunch of meetings in a suit from the very first day, about three quarters of the people that I used to eat lunch with would have been like, well, that's obviously he's sold out, like that's the end of that. It's just another, you know, now from now on it's gonna be business as usual. So I wanted to send a signal that that was not the case. So I don't mind that that got noticed a little bit. It's just been amazing to me how sticky that story is for the last year or so. Now, what I would rather us write about then and now would be the fact that, like what it really boils down to, I kind of covered this in passing when I said that like root cause analysis and single causes for failures are not really the answer, or they're not really worth looking for past a certain scale. And so people ask again and again and again, a question I've gotten more than any other, although the funding one is popular now and the election one is popular now, a question I've got more than any other is why did healthcare.gov fail, right? And there's not one answer. It's actually because the whole entire system just played out the way it always does. Like, this was just situation normal. Like, there are hundreds of projects that are just as bad. They just don't end up on CNN for 6 weeks at a time. So we need to talk about why that is that way. And the way that I believe in addressing that has to do with the incentives that are built into the ecosystem, because I don't think that at this scale there's any hope in any solution that depends on people acting against their own self-interest. So we have to correct the incentives that lead them to behave this way if we want to have any impact. I don't believe in anybody's 5-year plan or 10-year plan or 20-year plan for architecting new technology. Like, if you want to see an example of that, look up FAA Next Gen, it's called. If there are any private pilots, they almost always have a strong opinion on this. That is a plan, that is a place where the government literally in 1995 said, we will write down in a bill and pass it as a law all the technological changes that will take place in aviation over the next 20 years. It's not been going super well. I don't write a 5-year plan because I don't think my 5-year plan will hold up any more than anybody else's will. I think that the thing to do is address the incentives that this sector of the economy works under, and that's the only thing that you can hope for. So I would rather see a bunch of stories about that, but that probably would not get a whole lot of views on abcnews.com, so there you go.
Thank you.
I will end there. Thank you very much for your attention. I really appreciate it, and see you next year.